From Flourish DX, this is the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. With workplace mental health becoming a safety prerogative, this is the source of information on psychological injury prevention and health promotion.
Hi, and welcome to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. My name is Jason Van Shee, and I'm one of the hosts of the show. The aim of the podcast is to rapidly increase the knowledge and application of psychological health and safety in workplaces worldwide. To help with this, we have regular guests from around the world who are leading the way in this important area. But before I introduce our guest and topic for today, allow me to introduce my co-host, Joelle Mitchell. How are you today, Joelle?
I'm well, Jason. I had an interesting chat with my hairdresser on the weekend.
Yeah, I imagine you've got a very good relationship with your hairdresser because you see them about, what, once a month?
6 weeks-ish, depending on how together I am with getting my appointment. He's quite interested in sort of what we do here, and he's always keen to hear about the different guests that we've had on the podcast. And we're talking about sort of the idea of vicarious trauma and, you know, people who might be exposed to that sort of thing. And he made me realize that hairdressers are actually a group of people who are sort of in the front line in that perspective, because they just, their clients will offload all kinds of stuff on them. You never know what people are going to talk about while you're cutting their hair. And sometimes people do just want to offload whatever's going on in their lives on somebody, hopefully a stranger who doesn't know the rest of their friends and family. And he was saying that, yeah, it can actually be quite sort of a triggering event if it's a trauma that you've been through yourself in your life, to be there cutting someone's hair and having them share this horrible stuff with you, and then it just makes you relive all your own stuff. So that was a really interesting conversation. I hadn't really thought about that sort of group of service providers, but yeah, like hairdressers, beauticians, you know, people who do your nails, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it's probably more, I guess, people who are servicing women in that department, I'd imagine, because I'm pretty quick in and out of my barber. I don't really have a chance to offload, but.
Well, you know, you're making assumptions that all men are like you, Jason.
Yeah, actually, I do know some who take a lot more care of themselves than what I do, which is quite not hard, but yes.
Men can go and get waxed as well, you know, it's not just a lady thing.
But it's an interesting observation. So you're suggesting that hairdressers, as part of their TAFE certificate qualification, should also have some counselling or at least some training around psych hazards?
He was actually suggesting that the hairdressing industry actually needed to do something to better equip hairdressers in how to respond to those situations. Yeah.
Yeah. No, interesting. Well, maybe our guest today might want to chime in on that in a little bit. So it's probably a good time to introduce her in today. And I think she's the ideal person, not just to talk about hairdressing and vicarious trauma, but what's happening in Australia currently. Similar to myself and Joelle, she has a formal qualification in organisational psychology. Dissimilar to Joelle and myself, she's having a large influence on community and workplace mental health nationally as the chair and commissioner of the National Mental Health Commission in Australia. Welcome to the podcast, Lucy Brogdon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And I do have some comments on hairdressers when you're ready for them.
We might tack that on at the end in the space that we've got for a general conversation. But been a while. We have wanted to have you on for quite a while, Lucy, and I'm glad that we finally were able to schedule you in, being such a busy person that you are. So thanks for being on today.
Very happy to be here.
All right, Lucy, the first thing we like to ask our guests is whether they like to listen to podcasts, and if so, what are some of their favourites?
Look, I have, I'm probably relatively new to podcasts in a really sort of making sure I've got time for them in my schedule. I'm a big conversations follower. I am, like most of Australia, I think it still sits at the top there as one of the top podcasts. I also enjoy Occam's Razor, which is a science-based one. That's just neat little things around science that's really enjoyable. And being a woman over 50, I also enjoy The Hot Flush with two very funny women that are really making being over 50 and the joys of menopause something that's very accessible. So they're my three.
Not sure if I'll start listening to that one yet. It might not be quite relatable for me.
It might be something that you want to listen to in anticipation of future events, maybe.
Okay.
To help you be more empathic.
Possibly.
All right. Can you tell us about your professional career, Lucy?
Well, look, how long have we got? But that's probably the standard answer. So my original career started in banking and finance, but all along the way, I'd wanted to study psychology. Being the dutiful daughter that I was and still am, my parents kind of thought psychology was not a real thing to study, that I should do commerce or law or medicine. They're all lawyers. I'm genetically a lawyer. And so really that left me the choice of not wanting to do medicine, so doing commerce and a career in banking and finance. But all along that way, really wanted to keep doing the psychology. And at 30, my husband gave me the ultimatum of stop whinging that you haven't done it or go and do it. And fortunately, I was working at Macquarie Bank with an excellent boss who was the managing director, Alan Moss. And he was very encouraging in following my passion. And so I started doing psychology. It was a 20-year journey from the postgrad dip, the grad dip, postgrad dip, and masters to get there. And but you know, along the way, career changes, three children, husband with a mental health issue. So it was a bumpy road. But yes, I now do have my masters in org psych, and I work now, having moved from investment banking and finance to sort of organisational development functions to now working in mental health advocacy and public policy.
Fantastic. That's a really interesting career path. And I love to hear from people who have a little bit of a diverse, more of a diverse background, because I think for our listeners, it gives them a really good idea of sort of the breadth of different pathways into this particular field of work. So that's wonderful.
Yeah, no, we're very, very happy to take lawyers and accountants if they want to, you know, move into psychology. Fantastic. The more the merrier.
Well, I think there's a lot moving in. And I've got to say, while I didn't enjoy the banking and finance side of the work, the fact that I actually understand and can speak the language of business, I think working in the field of organisational psychology really equips me to hold my own with the businesses at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's it's a really critical skill for anybody who wants to, especially influence at the top level of management, to be able to speak their language.
Yeah, certainly seen some commentary recently around that with health and safety professionals as well, understanding, you know, how businesses actually operate and what's important to an executive level rather than just their little patch.
Yes, yeah, very much so.
So, Lucy, you got to tell me, what consumes the time of the chair of the National Mental Health Commission?
Oh, a whole range of issues. The job is technically, I think it's on paper 4 days a month, but it's really about 3 days a week. And that's fine. That's partly my choice. We do a lot of community engagement work with the work of the commission itself. We have the meetings of the commission, and there are 11 commissioners who all come from a variety of backgrounds. We have clinicians, we have academics, we have people working in various psychosocial support functions, and we have lived experience. And I'm really proud to be chair of the commission in the capacity as a carer, and to see that lived experience voice sitting at the highest level of policy is really a sign of great progress for us. I also wear the hat of chair of the Mentally Healthy Workplace Alliance, which is an initiative of the commission, really recognising that we need to have good policy and systems where we live, work and play. And, you know, those of us that have studied organisational psychology will probably have started some essay that said we spend the majority of our waking hours at work. And that is true. And really the workplace can be a place of prevention, of early intervention and supporting recovery and participation for those with more severe mental health issues.
Yeah, absolutely. So one day a week it's supposed to be, but you're spending 3 days a week in that. I know, I think pretty much every single mental health conference I see there's a photo of Lucy there. She's representing, waving the flag. So you do definitely get around and provide a lot of support. And as you say, you know, that consultation with the community is just so important.
Look, it really is. And it's a very privileged opportunity to have. I mean, my work in the commission has taken me to the Torres Strait, to the really remote parts of mainland Australia, to Tasmania, meeting with incredible people right across the country, really doing some incredible grassroots work, right up to people doing incredible systems design work that is just so fundamental as well. And I think the commission sees itself as a bit of a people's commission, trying to bring together those big system thinkers with the people down on the ground at the coalface, trying to do the implementation on a daily basis.
Terrific.
Yeah, important to bring all of those pieces together, really, at a national, from a national perspective, to have as cohesive a system, I guess, as possible. Yeah.
Yep.
A little bit like herding cats as well, though, I would imagine.
Sometimes.
All right, well, let's talk about the state of psychological health and safety in Australia, and in particular, as far as sort of the workplace goes. Can you talk us through some of the information and statistics that are available at the moment?
Look, there's a lot going on, and I think if we start from the perspective that the human cost of not doing this well is really significant, and that's what motivates me, but I know that there are different drivers around what's going to motivate business to do this well. But, you know, we know basically 1 in 5 Australians will experience some form of mental health difficulty in their lifetime. And we know that around 21% of people in the last 12 months have said that their mental health has impacted their ability to work. And that's probably a little lower than I would have expected. But you know, COVID has really tested our capacities, all of our capacities. We used to say at the commission we worked for the 1 in 5 Australians. More recently, our work is for the 5 in 5 Australians. We have quite a robust regulatory framework in this space, but still I can meet with boards and CEOs that will be somewhat surprised that they've got legal obligations in this space, and their legal obligations that go beyond the workplace health and safety legislation to issues around privacy, discrimination, harassment, carers' roles, etc. So there's a lot of regulation, but what I am struck by in this space is people saying to me, okay, I've got the obligation, what and how do I do things to meet that? And that's really been the challenge, and the work that we're trying to fill is, these are things you can do. People that have heard me speak at all these conferences will know I say the message is, this is more than yoga and fruit bowls. Often I'll go into organisations and they'll say, you know, oh, we've got yoga, we've got a gym, we've got fruit and healthy eating in the kitchen, and they're still not happy. And, you know, they're kind of nice things to have, but they're not the essence of creating that psychologically safe workplace or a place of thriving employees. And, you know, we see psychological safety as the compliance and the baseline for organisations, and really hope that they'll aspire to go beyond that, to create an environment where employees can thrive and be themselves. And we know that by doing that, productivity does go up, and that's good for their business. So it's really a big component of education to understand what needs to be done and how best to do it.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a similar observation that we've had with, you know, organisations that we talk to as well, that they just really, that there's a real lack of understanding about what this actually means for them. And, you know, yeah, they think that doing the awareness raising and stigma reduction is sort of all that they need to do.
Yeah. And you've touched on an important word, Joelle, because stigma is a real issue in the workplace. And, you know, if we are going to create cultures and environments that are safe for people, then we have to tackle the issue of stigma. Our colleagues at SANE Australia did a national report card on stigma last year, and that showed that 78% of respondents to their survey, and these are generally people living with mental illness, reported feeling strong stigma and discrimination in their workplace. And so I think these are things that we can tackle and overcome. And it's, Australia sadly has one of the lowest levels of participation in the OECD for people with mental health issues and their ability to work. And when we try to unpack that, we see very low levels of mental health literacy within our rehab sector, our return to work sector, our HR functions, and even our WHS functions. And so, you know, we know that the best way to address stigma is through education. It's not just awareness raising, it's really empowering people through knowledge.
Yeah, and I think the having that specialised knowledge, especially in the return to work function, is so important, because it's about, you know, recognising that you can actually have a mental illness and still be a productive member of the team, and you can contribute in meaningful ways. And it's about actually, you know, working with the care team to design the type of work that's actually going to help facilitate the recovery for that person. So, I agree, there's a big gap in that return to work area.
Yeah, and look, reasonable adjustments, it's somewhat a new space around some of these issues, but a lot of it is really comes from being able to have very open and safe conversations with people.
Yeah. I like how you're talking about with stigma reduction, the importance of language and people just understanding what terminology means. And I'm sure you would have had the discussions around the difference between mental health and mental illness. Those terms are psychological safety and psychological health and safety. Actually, I just saw that Dave Burrows wrote an article today around psychological safety and the conflation with that and psychological health and safety. So there's a lot of confusion out there. Do you have any commentary around that and the importance of getting our language right?
Look, I think language matters. We know that. We know that across a lot of domains. I think one of the things that we struggle sometimes with when is that if we get too pedantic on language, we have to remember that sometimes the horse is bolted. So rather than trying to fight language issues, we just need to establish our language of engagement when we are going into organisations and talking to people about what we mean. We'll probably come to this in the discussion, but we're working on the National Workplace Initiative at the moment, and language is coming through from business particularly as a big issue that they want to understand. They struggle with the use of the word mental in any context, but they're also struggling with the concept of the word well-being. And so I think rather than fighting all the language issues, it's probably important that we just, you know, when you go into an organisation, you set the ground rules, and this is what we're talking about. You might use this word, I might use that word, but this is where we're, you know, let's get to that common language ourselves.
Yeah, it's a bit frustrating for myself, you know, working in the psych health and safety space, and, you know, there's obviously this tailwind behind this idea of psychological safety that I guess Edmondson kind of made popular.
Yes.
And there was even, like, we had our first live panel this week with some really great people from around Australia on that, people like Jennifer Lowe, who you'd work closely with, no doubt.
Yes.
And, you know, I saw one of the participants of this live panel on psychological health and safety comment on someone else's link post about psychological safety, saying, oh, I was just on a live panel, or I was listening to a live panel on this earlier. I'm like, no, this is a completely different concept that we're talking about, right? So even after listening to this for an hour, she's still conflating psychological safety with psych health and safety. So sorry, it's just I'm maybe letting out some of my own frustrations around that, Lucy. So
it's usually ranting about these things, yeah. Jason, but it's your turn today, so I'm pleased with that.
Look, it's important because it does matter. And yeah. You know, it's going to matter more, as we've seen last week, the Attorneys General really decide on a coordinated course of action, generally speaking, around regulations and codes and things like that. So the language is going to get more important, and it's got not just a language for us to use, but if we're going to be speaking to business, they need to be understanding when we're talking about their issues of compliance, the things we would actually like them to be doing, and the more discretionary elements. And at the moment, it's a very confused space.
Yeah. Touching, I guess, more on what you said earlier about some of the confusion and this idea about well-being as well. Do you have any comments about some of the tensions you've observed between the individual and well-being, wellness approach, and I guess more of the systems level thinking and, you know, risk management, systemic kind of interventions?
I do. And so I think at one end, it's nice that we do things for the employees that are nice things to have, fruit, yoga, sport, massages, whatever you choose to have. I do worry that sometimes when people are bringing in psychological safety programs, psychological support programs, wellbeing programs, that they are very individually targeted and kind of missing the point that really an individual can look after many elements for themselves when it comes to their personal well-being or their personal health, whether that's mental or physical. But what we would like organisations to be doing is looking at themselves really in the environment that they're creating for their employees. And I think Tony LaMontagne's framing of some of this is really important when he basically says, you know, to paraphrase him, you kind of got to address the negative before you bring in the positive. So all those little individualized things that organizations are doing are kind of the nice to have, positive to have, but they can actually be somewhat harmful or negative in an environment where you're not really tackling the core issues and stresses within the organization. And so, you know, ideally we would like that balance to be looking at the organization itself, the team environment, and then the individual, rather than putting all the obligation on the individual to avail themselves of the offering and somehow make themselves happy in that context.
Yeah, I've made that comment before on this show and on LinkedIn that, you know, it's not the employer's obligation to make sure that individual employees are, you know, having high levels of wellbeing and caring for their mental health or mental illness, but it is their role to make sure that the workplace isn't creating a place where someone is going to become ill because of the experience of work or how work is designed or mismanaged.
Yeah, absolutely, Jason. But I think the challenge is if you actually go back to the literature that we collectively draw on, you know, Journal of Applied Psychology, Leadership Quarterly, whatever it might be, we're still seeing that a lot of the interventions, are, you know, despite the rhetoric around sort of meso, macro, et cetera, they're still very individualized approaches. Yeah. And I'm not sure how we get that language, you know, the research agenda, the workplaces and the people doing the implementation to really lift themselves up one level. It's kind of easy to keep coming down to the individual.
Yeah, I think that's the point, right? It's the easy, we're checking a box, we've done it. You know, we don't have to now think about, you know, the workplace and intervention. And hopefully, maybe with new regulation, maybe this ISO standard that is coming out next month, hopefully some of those things will get people to start to consider what they're doing, I guess, at that systems level. I like how you quoted Tony before, and Carlo Capanecchia will say something very similar, talking about his cake analogy. You know, you got to bake the cake and have a really good foundation first, which is the systemic stuff, before you start layering on all the icing. We're definitely of the same opinion here, right? Prevent harm first, you know, create that base kind of level of safety for people, and then you can kind of build on some of this, let's build wellbeing now. But it's a bit ignorant, I think, to tell people to be more mindful if they're working 14 hours a day and their boss is a prick. But
oh, exactly. You know, I've been into, you know, beautiful, shiny organizations that have, you know, world-class gyms that most of us would pay a fortune in membership to join. But at the same time, that, you know, they're running the highest suicide rate for their industry. And you kind of say, you know, shut the gym for a while. Look at the real issues that are going on here. Your gym is actually empty. Who can get here? No one.
So, I've got the same issue when companies hand out mindfulness apps or resilience apps to people. I'm like, well, the people who actually need them probably don't have time to turn on their phone and look at a mindfulness app. So,
well, if you've got a soapbox, this one's mine. Because, and if you'll indulge me a little bit, I do worry about the plethora of apps that are coming in to organisations. And I know I've heard Dave Burrows, that you mentioned earlier, speak to this point, but some of those apps are bringing in clinical instruments. They are asking people to record their state of well-being right through to a state of distress, but actually not offering a whole lot of quality support to those people. And it really troubles me, one, that people within our profession are kind of misusing instruments that they should know better, but also that, you know, to me, if someone is using an app with, say, a K10, and there's someone scoring very high in the distress domains, and the best they're going to get is an automatic email that says ring the EAP, I think we've really gone way off the mark in what we're trying to achieve for our employees. And it's a dangerous place, and it really troubles me.
Yeah, and that's another issue again, right? Like you say, the misuse of some of those clinical tools and trying to identify. I mean, some of these apps go under the guise of wellbeing apps, but really they're about mental illness identification with, like you say, not a lot of follow-up support. So,
absolutely. And so I think these are the elements around education that are so important in organisations, to know what they're buying, to be able to question what they're buying, and to make sure it's really fit for purpose.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Lots of opportunities for soapboxing here, but we probably need to continue, unfortunately, because otherwise we'd go all day. Let's talk about what's happening at a national level to address mental health.
At mental health generally? Or yeah.
Oh, the NWI probably.
Yeah, within the workplace.
Okay, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, I mean, we just got a great boost in the national budget for mental health. Generally, we've had a lot of big reform coming through the Productivity Commission, Vic Royal Commission, et cetera. So there's a lot going on, but it's actually been good for the workplace context, because people are starting to think through these domains that I referred to of where we live, learn and work. At the national level, workplace-wise, there had been the work of Maureen Dollard's review of the legislation that had been going on. The Productivity Commission looked at the issues around productivity and the huge cost to Australia of poor creating workplaces that are not good for people's mental health and wellbeing. And you know, this was in the order of billions of dollars, which goes to the bottom line of businesses, and I'll come back to that. But the National Mental Health Commission, working through the Mentally Healthy Workplace Alliance, which brings together somewhat unusual bedfellows. We have the ACTU sitting at the same table with the Business Council of Australia, the Australian Industry Group, with ACCI and Council for Small Business, COSBOA, and Superfriend and others, to really look at the issues of what's going on and to answer that what and how, and to allow organisations to effectively know when they're buying quality, what they need to buy, a framework for their approach to this. And then the piece of work we're currently looking at now is around evaluation of products and services, but evaluation and data tools for organisations to have. Now, that's not saying that we need to start with a greenfields. We actually think organisations have a lot of good data and information. They're just not so good at knowing how to use what they've got, interpret that and report that in a way that will be helpful to show progress. We often like to ask a lot of questions in things like engagement surveys and wellbeing surveys that don't actually allow us to measure change. You know, it's sort of how we perceive the organisation, which is an interesting phenomenon, but it's not really giving us a sense of the issue. And so how do we get some common data tools, benchmarking that goes beyond risk assessment into more aspirational change and organisational change? So it's a big piece of work. It's engaging people from right across the sector, businesses of all sizes, academics, practitioners, and the people working in WHS teams, HR teams, CEOs, board members, all kind of sitting in various work groups trying to tackle these issues together while working with regulators and the state jurisdictions on their programs at the same time.
So it's just a minor undertaking then.
Yeah, and most of it done last year during COVID. So we were all on screens and, you know, moving virtual sticky notes on virtual whiteboards, but making some good progress. And I can share with you the links to some of that if your listeners are interested in learning more.
Yeah, that'd be good. We can add those to the show notes so people can click on those and have a look through. So what has been your involvement in that project?
Kind of to be the noisy seagull, I suppose, sometimes, but I chair the Alliance, and so really sort of the Alliance itself, the Mentally Healthy Workplace Alliance, is effectively the steering committee for the project. And then I chair the evaluation working group. And spend a lot of time with the team, just working out where they're going, listening to their strategy discussions, speaking about the work, trying to really gauge and garner the interest, because, you know, in that time we've also had a lot of groups popping up wanting to do more work, learn more in this space through the Corporate Mental Health Alliance and other entities. So it's a very active and interested and curious space at the moment.
Good to hear that it's active and interesting and curious. Those are all good things for participants to be. So in terms of, I guess, the overall progress of sort of, you know, where you'd like to be versus where it is at the moment, whereabouts is?
So where we're at is, I think we've got about 12 weeks till we're sort of building some prototypes that we'll be going into the market to test with. If people are interested in that, very happy to include people in some of that phasing, looking at various approaches at the moment, not just around content, but how we best penetrate to business. Is it an industry approach? Is it a size of business approach? Is it a mixture of those? You spoke in the opening about hairdressers that are part of our small business strategy very much, but their industry is also very active in this space and have been quite a strong history of building a good set of resources. Our colleagues at EveryMind, actually one of the very first projects that EveryMind delivered was some basic sort of accidental counsellor resources for hairdressers for exactly this issue. And so, you know, often it can be, rather than working with a company, working with their industry to really tailor resources to suit them. So there's still a lot of thinking happening around design and the best way to really get that penetration into the businesses themselves, through their industries, through, you know, competition. Often the best way to sell something to a company is to tell them that their peers are doing it already. And so just finding those sweet spots and how we best structure around it.
Fantastic. So some really interesting things to expect in the next few months. So yeah, I'm excited to see what comes out of that.
Yeah, well, one of the things you just mentioned actually was the Corporate Mental Health Alliance. I actually caught up with someone from Clayton Utes a week ago who are on that alliance, and he was giving me a bit more of a background on it. But for the people who aren't aware, would you be able to maybe elaborate a bit more on that? What's that all about? Who's involved?
Sure, happy to. So I sit on their expert advisory group, and the Corporate Mental Health Alliance, it says that they're business-led, expert-informed, and so they're very clear that they come from a place of business. Steve Worrell, the CEO at Microsoft, is the inaugural chair of the alliance, but it's bringing together a number of our particularly large corporates and partnerships from a range of sectors. They are I can't remember whether it's a sister or an affiliate of the Corporate Mental Health Alliance in the UK, and creating their own Australian chapter at the moment in that space. But they have at their table, you know, the likes of Microsoft, the professional services firms like Clayton Utes, PwC, KPMG, Bunnings, the big four banks are there, Coles, Woolies, Qantas, and growing. So these are really representatives of some of our largest employers across the country. They only sort of really opened themselves up in October of last year, and they're on a bit of a steep learning curve. And, you know, our alliance and the Corporate Mental Health Alliance are trying to work really collaboratively to share our expertise, but have that great opportunity of business and even create some opportunities for some very exciting action-based research that tackles some of the issues we discussed earlier, where it all comes down to the individual. How can we test some big systems change across some of our larger employers?
Yeah, I think it will draw nicely on that whole idea of competition. Well, now I can see clearly what my competitor is doing in the space. And but it's about sharing and collaboration, right? People like, well, these companies want to share what they're doing well.
They do want to share at the moment. And I'm really impressed that that's the attitude they've gone in with. I think once they see some of the success, it'll be interesting to see if they still in that spirit of competition are as open and sharing, if they realize some of these things are actually proving to be really successful for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I can see that. Now, one of the things we've alluded to a couple of times on this call already are the Boland Review. Obviously, at the end of 2018, the Boland Review came out on the WHS Act, and out of 34 recommendations, recommendation number 2 was to incorporate psychological injury or psychosocial safety, health and safety, more into the Act. Obviously, the Productivity Commission inquiry report into mental health mentioned something similar. So out of 5 priority reform areas, one of them was to elevate psychological health and safety to the same level as physical health and safety. Now, really good timing that we've got you on this call, because there's been some movement on those recommendations from the Boland Review just in the last week. Can you talk to that movement? What's happened in the last week?
Look, I can talk to it a little bit. I don't profess to be an expert on the regulatory side. And again, I can share with you for listeners the link to the minister's communique. But just prior to the Workplace Health and Safety Minister's meeting last Thursday, we did see Victoria come out and say basically they were going to move ahead with their own framework in that regard. And that seems to be a very Victorian approach to a lot of this, to sort of take some of that first mover strategy. But basically the ministers have accepted that, and it's up to the jurisdictions now working out the details of that. So we've got states like New South Wales working on their codes and going forward. The model legislation can be useful in some regards because it does give us some commonality, but then we often lose that commonality in the regs that sit in each state and jurisdiction. And so without wanting to confuse people or myself too much, happy to share the links to the detail. But look, it's a progressive start. It is something that Boland Review did foreshadow, PC really endorsed. And I think that's the direction we're going, I guess. The question I have for myself is, this is a very different space to physical safety in many respects, where the risks are generally universal risk issues. We know that in our domain there are some universal risks, but we also know that that individual difference can play a big part in this too. And I'm just intrigued as to how that balance will be struck going forward to recognise individual difference, individual vulnerability versus the universal risk elements. And our maybe, those of us that work in this space probably know too much and so we're getting into the minutiae rather than focusing on the principle. But that's what I'm waiting to see, how that gets distinguished, I guess.
Yeah, I'm hoping we can draw on past experience from things like working hours kind of regulation, because, again, we're dealing with something that there are some universal things. If you stay awake too long, you're going to fall asleep make errors. But then there's some individual difference in susceptibilities based on things like sleep disorders, genetic predisposition, that sort of thing. So I think there's actually a lot of similarities between how we manage fatigue risk versus psychological risks in the workplace. Yeah. So hopefully we can draw on some of that.
Yeah, and fatigue's a great one model to look at. I think it really is. Although I must say, another little soapbox issue I have is, while it's great that we see our researchers wanting to work more closely with industry, sometimes I do see some of that research becoming a little bit self-serving for the industry that they're partnering with. The studies that kind of say surgeons can actually flourish, perform really well on very few hours of sleep. I'm not sure that that's really a helpful piece of research. Or the approach is not kind of really where I would like to see us tackling these issues. Just because a group found it okay doesn't make it okay. So,
yeah, no, Joelle and I were just having a discussion on this earlier this morning about consulting with non-subject matter experts and taking too much on from them especially when they're conflicted, as you say.
Yeah, we want you to say it's okay that we're sleep deprived. Okay.
Yeah, and they often want to know what is the maximum risk that we're allowed to work to, and then we will work to that versus going, well, how do we actually reduce the risk to as low as reasonably practicable? So, yeah, interesting. Yeah.
And look, I know I'm a bit of a Pollyanna in this space, but I do really believe that if you get that job and work design right, that the upside is really there for business, that, you know, you don't need to be pushing the boundaries of regulation to get productivity if you actually get the design right. It will just, it pays off for itself. But,
Yeah, I'm interested because all the ROI kind of reports that we see around mental health initiatives, they were generally focused on the individual level staff or the provision of EAP or mental health first aid. I haven't really seen any ROI on actually doing the systemic change that we're talking about, taking more of a health and safety approach. So it would be great to see a comparison. I'm sure, like you're saying, the systems level approach would probably have a better bearing on productivity.
And look, you raised something that's really interesting, Jason, because if I put my former Macquarie hat on, what we used to find was that in people-related projects within organisations, and I still hear this today, that, you know, and this is something that we're grappling with in the National Workplace Initiative, is how do you get that ROI formula that is actually listened to and followed? Because in my experience, what often happens is, depending on where the number comes from within the organisation, you will get, say, the finance people or others saying, unpacking the model and the assumptions rather than focusing on the bigger issue. And we do know that, you know, if we use the term wellbeing, the work we're doing is actually quite multifactorial. So our component may lead to that positive contribution, but there could well be other things going on. And people seem to get bogged down in the assumptions of the ROI model rather than the bigger conversation of what it is we're trying to achieve. And so sometimes I think maybe the ROI conversation can get us distracted and derailed rather than serving the purpose that we're trying to use it for.
Well, it serves the big four consulting firms pretty well because they keep seeming to put out reports and getting paid for these reports every couple of years by the looks of it. So it serves someone.
I'll leave that comment to you.
Yeah. That was not attributed to Lucy. That was attributed to me. I'm happy to take that one. Yeah.
All right. Lucy, would you like to share what's happening from the National Workplace Initiative?
So I guess we've covered a lot of that ground already, but we are sort of heading to the final phases and we have to deliver next year to government. So we are sort of looking at the frameworks, we're looking at our stakeholder engagement strategies, we're looking at the valuation. The model is really around, you know, those core pillars of protecting, responding and promoting, taking that role. It really says, you know, workplaces are a place of early intervention, prevention and recovery. It's more than just the compliance element and what can we do around those pillars. How do we best really make this part of the DNA of organisations? I think if we look in the Australian context at similar adjacent programs around diversity and inclusion, around, say, flexibility and other things, they've always been sort of bolt-on components rather than bringing into to true organisational change. And I think that's where we really need our org psychs working in the change management space of this to say, this is not just a project that you do a little bit of work, set and forget. This has actually got to be about the way we do things around here, is that continual journey. And, you know, I'll often go and talk to recruiters, internal and external. And I spoke at a recruiting conference once and said, how many of you do a job analysis before you go to market? And you know, there were like 200 people in this room and a handful put up their hand to say that's something they did routinely. And one person wanted to know what a job analysis was. Now, these are our core competencies. And it's getting that, you know, at the various stages across the employee lifespan, if we're not doing what we know works well, then you do have to scratch your head. This is, you know, not rocket science, as we say. If we actually do what we know works really well, we can make a big difference. And that's kind of the message that we're trying to put out there is, do the recruitment well, do the onboarding well, do the design of work well, do the performance management well, do the recognition strategy well, do the transfer to retirement well, do the redundancies and those things well with what we know works. And actually a lot of these issues will be well covered.
Yeah, I think there's an element there of org psychs also needing to be able to speak the same language as the executive and actually being able to explain in language that they'll understand why these things are important and why we should be spending money on them. You know, why do we need to do a job analysis before we recruit? What benefit does it actually give to the organisation? You know, what does the research actually say about how to do a redundancy well, as well as can be done, you know, to reduce survivor impact and all of those sorts of things. So, you know, as scientist practitioners, we know that there's all of that research out there, but it's about, I guess, having not only being able to communicate it to the executive, but having the opportunity to communicate it as well. So actually having a seat at the table and being involved in the, if not the decisions themselves, then in the planning of how we're going to actually implement those decisions.
Absolutely. And I think it then comes back to something that Jason sort of touched on at the beginning, which is why it's really important that in the work that we're doing, we actually understand the business that we're in. And by way of anecdote, when I worked at Macquarie Bank with Alan Moss as the CEO, he would and this was last century when we had hard copy newspapers, and every so often the HR department, to save money, would cancel the subscription to the Financial Review. And he would get very frustrated and in the end said, look, Central will cover the cost of the subscription to the Financial Review, but you, the HR team cannot service the business well if it is not reading the business publications. You need to understand the threats and opportunities facing the businesses you are serving. And if you don't understand that, you cannot be good at that. And I think it's important in the context of speaking to people that work in this space, just as we have a passion for organisational psychology or workplace health and safety, I think we also have to have a passion for the industry that we work in as well. And that needs to almost be equal to our professional passion. So whether it's in banking and finance, it's in manufacturing, it's in mining, that we almost see ourselves as being a miner rather than org psych, or an org psych with a deep passion in mining, because you can't speak the language of that business if you're not passionate and interested and curious and reading the ups and downs of that industry as much as you're kind of reading the current literature of the profession.
Yeah, I think about those things in terms of Venn diagrams. So, you know, who am I working with at the moment, and what's the Venn diagram of different disciplines that I actually need to be across to be able to do this work competently?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Joelle's been a quick study on what startup life is all about, and you know, capital requirements and investors and, yeah, all the rest. So
it's been interesting.
So it's been a fascinating conversation with you, Lucy. Obviously, you're at the forefront of what's happening nationally in a number of areas. So with your crystal ball that you've got there, I can see, what are your hopes for the future of workplace mental health here in Australia?
Look, I hope, if I'm being, you know, really hoping that we can achieve something, that we are just talking about that just as we talk in the health lens about trying to integrate the physical and the mental, it's the same in the workplace, that we are all about work that is creating a safe and positive culture and work environment for Australians everywhere. And that doesn't matter on what dimension of safety, it's a safe place to be, and it allows us to be leading the contributing lives, which is really the work of the commission that says everybody has that opportunity to participate, and they should be able to do that in a safe manner. And I do think while we're still talking with the distinction of physical and mental, it tells me that we've got a long way to go.
Yeah.
And do you have some words of advice for professionals who'd like to work in this area of psych health and safety?
Well, I think they're getting in at a boom time or a growth time. We're about to really to grow, and that's part of the function of the regulations that will be coming in. But it's also because I think we've got that recognition that businesses are starting to appreciate that this is something that they have to do, that there are costs associated, but there is upside from doing it well. And it's actually creates a fun place to be if you are doing this well. People want to be with their employers, and that's got to be a positive thing to be contributing to, I would have thought, as a professional, that I want to be a part of making work good for people.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's a fantastic aspiration to have for a career.
Yeah, no,
not it's, that I'm biased at all.
None of us are biased.
No, but it's as you say, it's meaningful work. That's why you're willing to put in the hard hours and in, you know, non-COVID times, traveling all around the nation all the time and attending all these conferences and doing all this consultation, right? Because it does make a difference, hopefully, at the end of the day.
Well, it does. And if we go back to, you know, our old friend Hertzberg, good work is good for you. You know, there's not a lot new in this space. And I think if we think about good work being good for you, it can apply at the individual level or the organisational level.
Yeah, and that's probably a good point to leave the conversation on, Lucy. So, look, thanks again so much for being willing to share what's happening at a national level and your role. Always get a lot out of our conversations and seeing you present. So thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Excellent. Thanks, Jason. Thanks, Joelle.
So that's brings us to the end of the episode today, listeners. So don't forget, we do record these over Zoom and then publish them on the Flourish DX YouTube channel. So if you'd like to see Lucy and her curtains behind her, then make sure you jump on YouTube. Also, if you prefer a shorter format rather than a long format podcast, we also do publish little short 2 to 4 minute clips from this. And there was a bit of gold that we'll be sharing on the Flourish DX LinkedIn page. Speaking of LinkedIn, Joelle and I are all over that. We're on there very frequently. So feel free to reach out and follow us or hit us up in our DMs. And that brings us to the end. So thanks a lot, listeners, and we'll catch you next episode.
You've been listening to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. To stay up to date with the latest on psychological injury prevention, follow Flourish DX on LinkedIn and subscribe to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast at www.psychhealthandsafety.com.